from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. War isn't what it used to be, at least according to the conventional wisdom, which holds that modern warfare is now irregular and asymmetric, making traditional forces largely obsolete. But military historian Max Boot argues that guerrilla warfare and insurgency are hardly recent developments. Those tactics were actually common for most of human history. In his new book, Invisible Armies, Boot traces the history of irregular warfare. He's Senior Fellow for National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of Invisible Armies, an Epic History of Guerrilla Warfare from Ancient Times to the Present. He joins us in the hour ahead after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of our forum program. Max Boot, the author of The Savage Wars of Peace, joins us for this forum hour to talk about his new book, Invisible Armies, an Epic History of Guerrilla Warfare from Ancient Times to the Present. Max Boot is the Jean J. Kirkpatrick Senior Fellow in National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, a regular contributor to the Wall Street Journal, and also someone who has served as a military advisor both in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we welcome him back to Forum. Glad to have you here again. Thank you.
Great to be back.
Well, I was talking before we went in the air just about the extraordinary scale of this book, the ambition of talking about guerrilla warfare and insurgencies and really what we now call asymmetrical fighting going back 2,000 years. But I want to get the thesis right out here because most of, I suppose, the listeners here would think that kind of irregular warfare is the anomaly. That's the historical exception. And that military organization is the rule, just the reverse.
Exactly so. In fact, unconventional warfare, irregular warfare, all of these terms which suggest that there's something weird or abnormal about it, it is in fact the norm. It is the longest running form of warfare that there is. Tribal warfare is essentially guerrilla warfare because tribes don't have this conventional military structure. They don't have command and control. They don't have uniforms, and they don't engage in the kind of toe-to-toe frontal battle which has characterized the so-called Western way of war since at least the days of the Greek hoplites. Tribes prefer to engage in raiding and ambush and stealth and attacking enemy villages and making their retreat. And that's the essential characteristic of guerrilla warfare, whether waged by nomadic tribes in the ancient world or today by various insurgent groups around the world. This has always been the most ubiquitous and dominant form of warfare.
It is really, as you're suggesting, the norm. And the irony is that there's been a trajectory for more massive military buildups, traditional militaries growing, while this has always gone on.
It has been. And one of the great constants of history is that conventional military forces hate to prepare for conflict against unconventional forces. They think that these kinds of adversaries are beneath them, because they don't go to staff colleges, they don't wear uniforms, they don't fight in the way that gentlemen are supposed to fight. And yet, every great military force in history, from the Roman legions to the modern U.S. Army, has had to spend most of its time and resources fighting irregulars. It's been inescapable.
Well, in your book, you talk about the nomadic raiders from the Persian highlands bringing down the First Empire. We go back to Alexander the Great, who had these nomads harder to fight than the conventional armies. And the fact is, they have always, even the Huns, the Roman Empire, which you also give us a briefing on and tell some really good stories throughout your book about so many of these insurgencies. But as you say, it's ubiquitous. And I'm wondering at this point, well, how this ties in with what we talk about as a contemporary vein of counterinsurgencies and insurgencies, and particularly the kind of terrorism that is so that puts the whole globe at risk, really.
It really does. And although this is the oldest running form of warfare that there is, it has changed over the centuries. And the biggest change over the last couple of centuries has been the rise of what I call the three Ps: politics, propaganda, and public opinion. None of those factors mattered when the Huns were attacking the Roman Empire in the 5th century. They matter very much today, however, because terrorist groups and guerrilla organizations of various kinds have figured out how to harness the news media, how to mobilize public opinion, how to use propaganda. And these have become their most potent weapons, something that enables them to bring down a great power or even a superpower, even if they can't possibly compete on a conventional military battlefield. They can nevertheless attack directly against the will of the population that they are fighting and degrade their will to fight and thereby prevail, much in the way that the Viet Cong did, for example, in Vietnam, or more recently insurgents have tried to do in Iraq and Afghanistan. This has become the great equalizer, something that allows even a relatively puny military force to bring down a military as powerful as the U.S. Armed Forces.
But again, the roots go way back. In fact, speaking about the U.S., United States use of propaganda against stronger enemies during the Revolutionary War.
Yes, that was absolutely a game changer in the way that the colonists figured out, with documents like Thomas Paine's Common Sense or our Declaration of Independence, they were not just trying to mobilize public opinion in North America in favor of independence. They were also trying to influence public opinion in Europe, in Britain in particular, to convince the people of England that they should not be fighting their brethren in North America. And ultimately, that campaign succeeded. The British Empire still had the resources to keep fighting, even after they lost the Battle of Yorktown in 1781, but they could no longer keep fighting because Parliament turned against the war. Public opinion had decided it wasn't worth fighting. That was a very powerful and significant precedent that would inspire countless imitators in the centuries to come.
We're talking with Max Boot, and he's here with us in studio. His new book, he's a senior fellow for National Security Studies with the Council on Foreign Relations, author of Invisible Armies, An Epic History of Guerrilla Warfare from Ancient Times to the Present. I want to get into some of the American history that you get into in your book. But first, again, just making this connection between the past, even the ancient past. People think targeted assassinations like the Israelis against Hamas or like the drones going into Yemen are something new, but again, they go back to the Republicans and the Romans.
They do. I mean, you know, I mentioned in my book how in the century before Christ's birth, the Romans were using targeted assassination to eliminate rebels to their rule in Spain. This is an ancient tactic, and it's had a mixed track record. I mean, counterinsurgents always think that if they kill a few insurgent leaders, they can prevail. But very many insurgent organizations over the centuries have shown tremendous resiliency and have been able to bounce back and replace leaders who have
been
lost.
Well, you're making martyrs and you're burgeoning more often, aren't
you?
Yeah,
it can often backfire. I mean, look at the modern day where the Israelis have managed to eliminate many leaders of Hamas and Hezbollah over the years, and yet both Hamas and Hezbollah are stronger than ever.
With the help of Iran, one should.
Well, of course, they have a lot. That's part of what makes them so resilient is because they have outside assistance.
Getting back to American history here, you write about the American Hornets during the Revolutionary War. And I suspect even some serious students of American history don't know about this side of our revolutionary history.
Well, there was a significant role for guerrillas in fighting the British, especially in states like New Jersey and South Carolina, where there was not a significant Continental Army presence. And especially in South Carolina, you had legendary guerrillas like Francis Marion, the Swamp Fox, and others who, after the collapse of organized resistance against the British, nevertheless staged constant hit-and-run raids on British convoys and outposts throughout the backcountry of South Carolina and gradually wore down British resistance. And, you know, the British could not stop them, even though they sent out Bannister Tarleton, one of their most enterprising and ruthless young officers. He could not bring these guerrillas he could not track them down, and so they managed to escape and eventually to drive the British out of the state. It was one of the great guerrilla successes of the American War of Independence.
And can you give us a little brief about the quiet American, Edward Lansdale?
Well, he was one of my favorite characters. He's somebody who was a legend once and has now been unfairly forgotten. He actually got his start in the ad industry in San Francisco in the 1930s, helping a little-known garment maker named Levi Strauss to market their products to the East Coast. Then when war broke out, he joined the Army, and eventually he wound up in the Air Force and the CIA, and in the late 1940s was sent to the Philippines to help them deal with this Hook Rebellion, a communist uprising of the period. And what he didn't have any troops to assist him. It was just him out there by himself going out into the boondocks, talking to the people of the Philippines, trying to make friends and trying to organize resistance against the Hucks, which he did brilliantly with the help of a Filipino friend that he cultivated named Ramon Magsaysay, who became Minister of National Defense and then President. And together, Lansdale and Magsaysay defeated the Hook Rebellion. And afterwards, Lansdale went to South Vietnam, a newly created state, where he made another friend named Diem, who happened to be the new leader of South Vietnam, and he helped to organize the new state of South Vietnam. So he had a large impact on history, and it's unfortunate that we don't remember him today because he really was one of the leading counterinsurgency strategists of the 1950s and 60s.
Well, speaking about things that we don't remember as much, you seem to come across with a fairly strong conviction that we have neglected two rather important stories historically as far as American history is concerned, John Brown's attack on pro-slavery interests, which, of course, kids read about in their history primers and all that, but also the KKK against the Reconstruction government, and that particularly seems to be left out of the picture.
It does, and when we talk about the history of terrorism, we often talk about the anarchists or other European groups, and we forget the American roots of terrorism. The way that John Brown, for example, was a very successful terrorist in the pre-Civil War era. And remember, terrorists are generally so weak, they can't accomplish anything on a conventional military battlefield, but they can make headlines, they can change opinion, and that's exactly what John Brown did with his raid on Harper's Ferry, which made him a martyr. And he really mobilized anti-slavery sentiment in the North. Then, of course, after the Civil War, the Ku Klux Klan was fiendishly effective at undermining all those civil rights that had been gained during the course of the Civil War with a campaign of terror aimed at the newly freed slaves in the South and at the Republican office holders who were trying to help them and to enforce the guarantees of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments with their campaign of terrorism. In fact, the Klan in many ways undermined and set back the entire verdict of the Civil War so that it would be another century before African Americans would gain their civil rights. I mean, this was a terrible campaign, but it was effective, and it deserves to be remembered in terms of effective terrorist campaigns in history.
Well, when you talk about the anarchists here in the United States, of course, Sacco and Vanzetti come immediately to mind, but they were martyrs of a different sort. They were not necessarily involved in any kind of asymmetrical warfare or tactics of a military nature or anything like that. But you point out that some of the, in today's world, some of the successes that have come about in just in terms of successful insurgencies, one has to think about Cuba and Castro, of course, but also in Afghanistan with the Mujahideen fighting the Russians. And, of course, Vietnam. But the anarchist movement hasn't really had many successes that add up, has it? Either here or abroad, for that matter.
No, they haven't. I mean, the anarchists kind of hobble themselves because, by definition, they're anarchists. They don't believe in organization. But if you don't believe in organization, it's very hard to get anything done. And so as a result of that, you know, they've been around a long time. And in the late 19th century, there was actually, you know, a war on terror that was waged on anarchists. And civilized society thought that they were a menace that would bring down states. And in fact, they managed to assassinate a lot of world leaders, including President McKinley was assassinated by an anarchist, along with many other world leaders of the period. And so they created a lot of terror, but they just didn't get a lot done because at the end of the day, they had no program that they could actually implement because they were anarchists.
Is there a way that Islamic militarism comes into focus in this whole history that you've presented for us, this large canvas?
It does. I mean, when you look at the motivating forces behind insurgency, they have changed substantially over the course of centuries. And to perhaps generalize over broadly, I would say that in the 19th century, liberalism and nationalism were the primary forces driving insurgency. Then in the 20th century, it switched to being Marxism and nationalism. Those became the defining movements of our time. Then, since 1979, I argue in the book, the defining movement of insurgency has been jihadism, this Islamist extremism, which came to the fore with the events of 1979, including the takeover of the American embassy in Tehran, and a lesser-known attack on the American embassy in Islamabad, which was burned down to the ground by mobs. the siege of Mecca, which was undertaken by radical Islamist extremists, and of course, at the end of 1979, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, which became this great galvanizing cry for Osama bin Laden and many others. So ever since then, these jihadists have really been in the driver's seat.
It's ideological, too, even though it seems to come under the rubric often of religious fanaticism. It's tied to an ideology and nationalism have always been, other than anarchists, kind of the main ingredients in these kind of insurgencies, haven't they?
It really is, and I would stress, in fact, many of the continuities between Islamist terrorists and leftist or nationalist terrorists or insurgents of decades past, I don't think the differences are that great. I mean, some people will say, well, how can you possibly fight these guys when they're willing to kill themselves to kill you and they're suicidal and so on and so forth. In fact, there is a limited supply of suicide bombers. But if you look at the history of nationalist and leftist movements, they produce plenty of martyrs, too. I mean, look at the way that the Viet Minh fought at Dien Bien Phu against the French with wave after wave of Vietnamese infantry charging right into French machine gun nests, knowing they were going to be killed, but clearing a path for their comrades. I mean, that's as suicidal as anything that any Islamist extremist would do today.
Well, because some of these insurgent movements or those are guerrilla warfare are on, shall we say, the side that doesn't have power or that certainly has less power than what they're going up against. Is there a kind of a martyr mindset in that runs throughout history here too?
There can be. And, you know, one of the defining characteristics of guerrilla warfare is it is the war of the weak. There are not a lot of people, and in fact, really none that I'm aware of, who would voluntarily wage guerrilla warfare if they have the capability to field conventional military forces. That's always their dream, but they don't have that power, and so they resort to these kinds of hit-and-run raids because they're too weak to do anything else. And sometimes, if their situation is desperate enough, they may just throw away their life in a desperate gesture to try to gain sympathy or support for their movement. But in general, there's a myth that guerrilla warfare is the Asian way of warfare. It's the kind of war of a particular culture. It really isn't. It's been universal throughout history of any group that doesn't have the power to fight in conventional means.
By the way, if you just joined us, we're talking with one of the nation's leading military historians, Max Boot, here with us in studio, who is a senior fellow for national security studies with the Council on Foreign Relations, and whose new book is Invisible Armies, an epic history of guerrilla warfare from ancient times to the present. And war isn't what it used to be, at least according to conventional wisdom, holding that modern warfare is now irregular and asymmetric, making traditional forces largely obsolete. But Max Boot, as I said earlier on, argues that guerrilla warfare and insurgency are hardly recent developments. The tactics were actually common for most of human history. If you'd like to join us, I'd like to invite you to do that now. Our toll-free number is available, and we welcome your phone calls and your participation in the program. It's live and interactive, so become interactive here, and let's have you join our conversation with any questions or comments you have. The toll-free number to call is 866-733-6786. Again, you can join us from wherever or however you're listening, 866-733-6786. And you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or simply go right to our website and post any questions or comments there at kqed.org/forum and click on the segment, or go to our Facebook page or tweet us, and our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. But feel free to join the program. Again, toll free at 866-733-6786 or emailing forum@kqed.org. You write a lot about figures that are certainly familiar to so many students of history, Toussaint Louverture in Haiti, Garibaldi in Italy, Mao Zedong, Che Guevara. But the archetypical figure often that comes into focus here in terms of leadership is often Lawrence. There are a number of reasons for that, clearly. I mean, he was an archaeologist, but then he became this warrior and this figure of tactics and so forth. And he stands out in many ways, doesn't he?
Well, T. Lawrence was certainly an extraordinary figure. Of course, a lot of his legend was not really his own doing. It was created by this very enterprising Chicago newspaper man named Lowell Thomas, who literally met with him for a couple of days, and out of that created this moniker of Lawrence of Arabia and wrote a book called With Lawrence in Arabia and created a slideshow and lecture that millions of people saw after World War I. And, you know, Lawrence was such a romantic figure after the—
Not to mention the movie, of course.
Well, the movie, of course, for a more modern generation, which took the legend and put it on the silver screen in that magnificent movie, where nowadays when people think T. Lawrence, they think Peter O'Toole, right?
Exactly.
But a lot of the reason why Lawrence became such a legend was because after this horrible, grinding warfare of the trenches on the Western Front, people were looking for an escape. They were looking for a more romantic figure, and they found it in this very slight Oxford-educated Englishman who spoke fluent Arabic, wore Arabic robes, and led the Bedouin in this war against the Ottoman Empire. And, you know, Lawrence really enhanced his own legend because, in addition to being this very inspirational guerrilla leader, really self-taught military genius, he was also a great writer. And he produced one of the great classics of insurgent literature, Seven Pillars of Wisdom, which is a book which is still read to this day. So, you know, if you can write well, you can that helps to make your name. And Lawrence was a brilliant writer.
A lot of these revolutionaries came from, it's often been argued, fairly well-to-do background.
Some did. Fidel Castro, for example.
Che Guevara.
Che Guevara, they were both, you know, sons of privilege. Che was from a very aristocratic family in Argentina. Fidel Castro's father was a major landowner. Even Mao, who came from more modest circumstances, his father was a fairly wealthy peasant. He wasn't in, you know, at the bottom of the social ladder. And that should make sense because in order to become an insurgent leader, at least in the modern era, you have to have some education. I mean, you really, people who lead insurgencies tend to be intellectuals to one extent or another. They read books, they have ideas. And, you know, for that kind of background, it helps if you have some kind of privilege to begin with so that you have the ability to be schooled, because back in the old days, there was no public education. You really had to be born into the upper classes to even be able to read and to have access to schooling.
Talking to Max Boot, his new book, Invisible Armies, An Epic History of Guerrilla Warfare from Ancient Times to the Present. And Bernard says, what extent is a terrorist organization required to have a support among the population to be successful?
Well, terrorists don't require that much public support because they tend to be very small organizations. They can often be a few dozen or a few hundred individuals. And yes, they do need some sympathizers to operate, but not that many. I mean, look at the way that the Baader-Meinhof gang, for example, operated in West Germany in the 1970s. They were described as waging a war of 60 against 60 million. It was very few people. But nevertheless, we're able to keep operating. Whereas if you want to have a guerrilla group that actually controls territory, that can field units of thousands of individuals, you need a lot more support in order to do that. And that's a much more substantial undertaking, which is why, you know, in modern liberal Western states, you don't see guerrilla movements. They don't have that much support. But you do see terrorist groups because they're always going to be a handful of extremists, and they're very hard to stamp out.
And the terror campaigns, as you say, particularly in the modern context, have become in some ways almost inseparable from putting out the propaganda, which now, of course, the Internet plays an integral role in.
It does. And in fact, Osama bin Laden went so far as to say that the media war is 90% of the whole in the waging of jihad. That's how much importance he attached to it. And he certainly made good use of the media, whether it was, you know, the Internet, satellite television, cell phones, every modern communications medium Al-Qaeda has adopted and often used much more imaginatively than we do.
Well, again, if you'd like to join us with Max Boot, you're cordially invited to do so. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Again, the book, Invisible Armies, An Epic History of Guerrilla Warfare from Ancient Times to the Present. Our guest, Max Boot, and we'll return and hear from you when we do. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Max Boot, who said to me off air, didn't have any expectations of hearing about historical warfare from Mike Tyson on this trip, but those kind of unexpected surprises that often come with this world of radio. And glad to have you here with us. He's here with us talking about his new book, Invisible Armies, An Epic History of Guerrilla Warfare from Ancient Times to the Present. And it is a large scale. It's a very ambitious book, well-documented, well-researched, covering really 2,000 years. And if you want to find out about guerrilla warfare, particularly through history and this kind of insurgent warfare, what we now call asymmetrical warfare, then you've come to the right place. Let me go to your calls here, and we'll begin with Mark, who's joining us from Hillsborough. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
So the question is, how and when do terrorist groups go from being called terrorists to revolutionaries or even heroes in some cases? I've always been fascinated with, you know, some of the examples like the Uyghur, Muslim Uyghurs in northwest China, you know, or even in Tibet, when we used to support them, then later supported the Chinese and calling the Muslims out there terrorists. For example, you know, in the U.S., I think, you know, the Harper's Ferry raid. At what point does history judge these people as positive versus negative? And I know it's a appreciate your insight.
Well, it's always a linguistic battlefield as much as anything else in this kind of war. And counterinsurgents always try to label whoever they're fighting as terrorists. And terrorists, of course, generally resist that label, with some minor exceptions, like the Russian nihilists of the 19th century, who actually didn't mind being called terrorists. But ever since then, pretty much every terrorist under the sun has said, I'm not a terrorist, I'm a freedom fighter, I'm a soldier, I'm a jihadist, or what have you. And, you know, conversely, counterinsurgents have been very determined to label even guerrilla fighters as terrorists. I mean, it was sort of comical in Malaya in the 1950s when the British were facing the Malayan Racist Liberation Army, which was a classic Marxist-slash-nationalist insurgent group, and the British insisted on designating them as communist terrorists. That was their official designation. So, you know, these terms in many ways have been stripped of meaning, and they've just become another way that you can fight these wars.
Well, you know the old cliche, of course, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter,
right,
or woman's, and so forth.
Sure,
but it gets confusing to many. I mean, because, you know, when the movement, when the Arab Spring started, Mubarak was saying these are terrorists, of course, that would be almost standard, boilerplate. Same thing in Libya with Khomeini, same thing now in Syria with Assad. But the fact is that some of those are terrorists, and some of them are, you know, part of al-Qaeda, which is deemed to be a terrorist group, and some of them aren't.
Right. But the further point I would add is even some groups that are genuinely labeled terrorists, they may have laudable objectives, and you may wind up supporting them because you think what they're doing is still the right thing to do. I mean, in the course of my research, I ran across terrorists that I liked, like Michael Collins, the great architect of the Irish struggle for independence. He was a terrorist I'd love to have a beer with. He was a good guy, even though he could maybe be labeled a terrorist. So, you know, the label should not be the end of the examination. You need to go deeper than that and see what kind of person is this, what are they actually fighting for, and look beyond the tactics they may use to try to achieve their objective.
Well, it's also the way history turns out. I mean, Mandela was thought to be a terrorist,
sure,
obviously.
Yeah.
I mean, the African National Congress was a terrorist organization in the eyes of the West. And now, of course, Nelson Mandela is elevated to the great stature that many people feel he deserves. Or you write about Toussaint L'Ouverture in Haiti, and I suppose he was considered a terrorist. Now he's, of course, believed to be the man who liberated this country from white hegemony, and I mean, the country still has terrible problems, but one of the poorest countries in the world, or at least this part of the world, and yet it wouldn't have been free of white domination had it not been for Toussaint L'Ouverture.
That's true, and he was one of the truly successful freedom fighters of the last several centuries, but also a very complex and ambiguous figure. Because in more recent years, we have learned that not only was he this indomitable battler against the sins of slavery, but it turned out he had actually been freed prior to the start of his rebellion, and he had actually owned some slaves of his own. So he was, you know, very hard to pin down. But of course, he is the great national hero in Haiti, and deservedly so, because he fought one of the bloodiest and most difficult uprisings ever. And in fact, it was the Haitian Revolt of the 1790s was the only successful slave revolt in history. And it probably wouldn't have been successful were it not for the genius of Toussaint L'Ouverture and the way he managed to beat the French and defeat Napoleon's crack troops. That was an amazing achievement.
It was indeed. And when we think of the freedom of our own republic, as long as we're talking about slave owners, Thomas Jefferson was, of course, a slave owner. But let me get to more of our callers here, and we'll go to Dale. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call, Michael. Good to speak with you again, and nice to hear the program, Mr. Boot. One needs to look no farther than our very own American history and the very first battle, misnamed the Battle of Bunker Hill. It should have been the Battle of Breed's Hill, when a ragtag bunch of men built very hastily constructed berms of logs and dirt and whatnot, and hid behind them, and to the high degree of offense by the British. I mean, how could they be so so crude and ungentlemanly? And I'll take my response off the air. Thank you.
All right, thank you for the question, Maskwood.
Well, there's no question that the British troops were chagrined by what they considered to be some of the ungentlemanly tactics employed by the Americans that they fought, who would snipe at officers from behind trees and rocks and do other things that they considered to be not quite cricket. And the interesting thing is actually George Washington himself was very suspicious of these militia groups who tended to fight in guerrilla fashion, because he himself had gotten a start fighting with the British Army on the frontier, and he wanted to assemble a conventional military force that would be seen as respectable in the eyes of the world. So Washington himself was very suspicious of these guerrillas and really looked down his nose at the militia groups. He really wanted to have an organized continental army that was a mirror image of the British force.
We go to some emails here. James asks, why have we not seen attacks on small civilian targets in this country?
That's a good question. I think a lot of it has to do with the very effective homeland security measures that have been taken since 9/11. But I think in many ways, our most effective line of defense is something we don't think about, which is our ability to assimilate immigrants. Europe has had much more of a problem assimilating Muslim immigration. They have much more of a disaffected Muslim underclass, which is can be a breeding ground for terrorism. That hasn't really been the case in the United States. We've managed to integrate Muslim citizens of many nations, and I think that's, in fact, the most successful counter to terrorism that we have.
Another listener writes, could the guest speak about digital warfare? It seems that guerrilla warfare can be extremely effective when the target is a protected network or state secrets or operating code. Both anarchist groups like Anonymous and governments like the United States, think Stuxnet, and China, think recent infiltration of major U.S. corporations, can devastate governments, infrastructure, business, etc.
Cyber warfare is definitely a growing area of warfare. And, you know, we've seen a lot of headlines about the cyber attacks that have been launched by Chinese hackers, Iranian hackers, Russian hackers, and conversely, the way that the U.S. and Israel have cooperated to hack the Iranian nuclear program. It's only a matter of time before terrorist groups start to employ these weapons on their own, because it doesn't take a lot of infrastructure. All it takes is a computer science degree, a little knowledge, and you can figure out how to launch cyber war. And, you know, that's something where we're very vulnerable, because our civilian networks are not well protected. So this is an area where I suspect terrorist groups will attack in the future.
I'm afraid that I think the same about drones. I mean, the Iranians have one of our leading technological drones, and it can't be too far away that there will be groups that are perhaps operating out of places that are rogue states, or that are states that where you can't find the fingerprints of where the drones are coming from, where drones might be hitting us.
You're absolutely right. In fact, Hezbollah has already operated some drones over Israel. It's only a matter of time. I mean, it's the height of hubris to think that technologies like drones are going to stay the preserve of the United States. They always spread all over the world and fall into the hands of our enemies as well as our friends. It's inevitable. That's one of the lessons of history.
Certainly with nuclear weaponry, it is. And here's a caller, I think, right on the subject of the new technologies. John, hi.
Taking my call. Yes, I wanted to ask your guest his thought about the future of asymmetric warfare, given the predominance now of GPS, facial recognition, the listening to virtually every communication on every channel, types of technology that we're seeing employed by governments, not just our own.
Well, there's no question that governments have powerful surveillance technologies. But what always happens is whenever you have a powerful tool of offense, somebody will figure out how to defend against it. And often it's a very simple, low-tech defense. I mean, look at the way that Osama bin Laden managed to stay free and on the loose for over a decade by simply going off the grid. He didn't have a cell phone. He wasn't attached to the internet. He knew that we would monitor all these electronic devices. So he communicated with very low-tech, primitive means of using couriers. That, of course, created another vulnerability, which the CIA was eventually able to exploit. But, you know, our enemies have a decent understanding of the kind of technological potential that we have at our fingertips, and they do employ ways to counter it. It's inevitable. These technologies are never going to be perfect.
Our guest again is Max Boot. His new book, Invisible Armies, An Epic History of Guerrilla Warfare from Ancient Times to the Present. And we've got a listener who's, I think, not happy with what you said about anarchists. He says anarchists do believe in organization, just that it should be voluntary. And he sends this noun definition from some lexicon. Anarchism, belief in the abolition of all government and the organization of a society on a voluntary cooperative basis without recourse to force.
Well, that may be. But just historically speaking, anarchists did not have a great organization. I mean, that's the reality. In the 19th century, there were anarchists operating in many countries, but they tended to operate in very small cells of, you know, a dozen people or something like that. There was very little cooperation between them. Occasionally, there would be anarchist congresses, or they would publish newsletters or newspapers. But let's face it, they just were not well organized. They were not. An anarchist movement can't be as hierarchical as a terrorist organization really needs to be effective.
Another listener writes, your guest comments that there's a limited supply of suicide bombers, I believe, is incorrect. Our unpopular drone strikes and Israel's anti-Palestinian policies ensure that there will be an ample supply in the Middle East for an indefinite period of time.
Well, you know, there will be certainly suicide bombers, but they don't just materialize out of the blue. And what we found over the course of the last decade is that organizing suicide attacks is actually a very complex undertaking. It goes well beyond having a person who's willing to carry out the attack, although simply to find that person, to indoctrinate him or her, and to prepare him for the attack requires an infrastructure to surveil the target, to prepare the vehicle or the explosives, to, you know, find the person who's willing to carry out the attack, to, you know, make a martyrdom video, do all these other kinds of things. It requires a fairly large operation. And what Israel, the United States, and other powers have found in combating these kinds of terrorist organizations is, okay, even if there are people who are willing to give up their lives, you can still make it impossible for them to be effective by disrupting their chain of command, by getting inside their network and preventing them from doing all these things that are necessary to carry out effective suicide bomber attacks.
Well, when you were talking before about how history can eclipse the view of some terrorist organizations, or at least the flux of history change it and so forth, I can't help thinking about the PLO. I mean, in some respects, it's almost as if it's been replaced or supplanted by Hamas as being a leading terrorist organization. Now they talk about Fatah. They're talking largely about the West Bank. And they're talking about really a West Bank government that seems to be, or at least in recent years, have wanted to get rid of the settlement so some kind of peace brokering could go on, as opposed to Hamas, which now has become the leading advocate for the destruction of Israel.
Yeah, there's no question that the PLO and Fatah in particular have made a major odyssey over the course of the last several decades, from being the most notorious terrorist organization in the world in the 1970s when they were carrying out the attack on the Munich Olympics and other high-profile terrorist activities, to being hailed in the 1990s as peacemakers. Now I think their image has been a little bit tarnished because Arafat resorted to terrorism once too often, and he backed the Second Intifada after the Camp David Accords, which was widely seen as being very destructive to Palestinian hopes of statehood, because it led the Israelis to come back into the West Bank. It led to tanks, you know, crashing down Arafat's headquarters. But now, you know, with Arafat's successors, they are seen as being the moderates in the Palestinian world, whereas it's Hamas, as you rightly say, which is seen as the radical terrorist bomb throwers of today.
And then we go to Neil joining us. Good morning, Neil.
Yeah, two questions. First, I'd like a little more of your opinion on Ed Lansdale. Was he actually considered an admirable person, at least by you anyway? The myth that Lansdale was used as a model for the Quiet American by Graham Greene turns out to be wrong. Another question is this. You said that revolutionary leaders usually have to have some education. Do you think that the revolution in Mexico in 1910 failed precisely because Villa and Zapata weren't very well educated?
Well, that's an intriguing argument. I think maybe you could argue that Pancho Villa and Zapata and some of these other leaders of the Mexican Revolution were not well-educated. They did not have a well-thought-out strategy and ultimately were not successful. I mean, in terms of Lansdale, I do think he was a pretty admirable person, although flawed like anybody else. And you're right, by the way, that it probably is a myth that he was the model for the central character in Graham Greene's novel, The Quiet American. But that was certainly the prevalent impression at the time. And, you know, Lansdale had a lot of similarities to the American figure that Graham Greene was caricaturing.
And thanks, Neil, for the call. Lee writes, the word terrorist is not synonymous with rebel. It means groups or individuals who use specifically attacks on civilians in order to terrorize the populace and bowing to the desires of the terrorists. It isn't terrorism when members of the military are attacked, even if it's a sneak attack. Thus, terrorism can be a tactic of the state or of non-state actors. Another listener says, Boot was a big booster of the invasion of Iraq. Surely he must now concede that it was the biggest military mistake in U.S. history and provided an invaluable boost to the recruiting efforts of guerrilla movements that have grown stronger because of it.
Well, we've made a lot of military mistakes in U.S. history. I'm not sure I would say that the war in Iraq was the biggest one of all. I think we did make a huge mistake by overthrowing Saddam Hussein and not preparing for the aftermath and not doing more to stabilize Iraq after Saddam was gone. That was a huge and costly mistake from which we only recovered because of the surge in 2007-2008, which finally led to a 90% reduction in violence.
But let me get you on record here. I mean, would you agree with the idea that it was a mistake to go into Iraq, particularly since there were no WMDs?
I certainly think that if we'd known in advance that there were no WMDs, neither I nor anybody else would have suggested invading Iraq. Clearly, it was based on false intelligence, but it was false intelligence in good faith. I don't think there was an active effort to deceive anybody. This was generally what the American intelligence community and our allied intelligence services around the world, this was their consensus view.
Then why not go into North Korea? Because they do have WMDs, and they have declared us as an enemy. We're still technically even at war with them.
Well, the simple fact of the matter is it would be the fact that North Korea already has nuclear weapons makes them almost immune to attack. And that's why we should be very worried about Iran or other states getting nuclear weapons, because once they get nuclear weapons, they become much more powerful. And there's very little you can do about it.
On we go and bring Frank into the discussion. Hi, Frank.
Yeah, good morning, Michael. I had a question. Your guest mentioned Michael Collins earlier, the Irish guerrilla leader, and I've read that he was a very original thinker, tactician in guerrilla warfare, and wrote a book that was later studied by Mao Zedong. Does he know anything about that? And could he comment about the IRA during that period of time, 1919-1921, during the Irish War for Independence? Thank you.
Thank you.
Michael Collins was a brilliant insurgent strategist, somebody who he spent the entire war against the British in Dublin, bicycling around on an old bicycle, often making his escape from British troops as they were going into the front of a dwelling. He was escaping out the back, and he coordinated a very effective campaign to blind the British intelligence apparatus, to assassinate detectives and spies, and and prevent them from figuring out what the IRA was up to. But at the end of the day, what really made Michael Collins an icon and a great man, I think, is that he was willing to make concessions in order to achieve peace. And he made a deal with the British that left Northern Ireland still part of the British Empire and gave freedom to the South. This was a deal which was rejected by many of his IRA comrades, who then went to war against the Republic and killed Michael Collins. But at the end of the day, Michael Collins was not only a great insurgent, but also a peacemaker. And I think for both those reasons, he deserves to be honored and remembered.
Well, who is the most, just from the standpoint of military tactician, who rises to the top, in your judgment, as far as insurgent genius, if you will?
Well, Michael Collins is certainly up there. General Giap, the strategist of the Viet Minh and Viet Cong, is certainly up there as well. Mao Zedong was obviously incredibly influential, as was T. Lawrence. I mean, those are some of
the big ones there. Yeah. Max Boot, good to have you with us. Thank you so much. Max Boot is the author of Invisible Armies, an Epic History of Guerrilla Warfare from Ancient Times to the Present. Let me actually try to get another caller in here, and that's you, Adam. Are you okay, Max? You're going through a little...
Sorry, this is one of the occupational hazards of a book tour.
Yeah, Adam, go ahead and talk while he's recovering his voice here.
I have a question about the implications on the increasing access and cheapness of biotechnology in future asymmetrical or guerrilla warfare, or actually terrorism. Terrorists getting their hands on bioweapons are creating genetic diseases to attack perhaps a food supply.
You're asking about accessibility?
The implications, because it is much more accessible and it looks to only be more accessible in the upcoming years.
Well, it is something we need to worry about because, like cyber war, biological warfare is something that is relatively accessible without a lot of industrial infrastructure or a conventional support base. So it is certainly something that potentially a grad student in biology could do and could cause massive devastation. So it is one of these asymmetric technologies that we need to be very wary of in the future.
But we also need to be wary, it seems to me, of who's going to get their hands on weaponry, which particularly in the former Soviet Union might be a lot more accessible than we were willing to admit, despite the safeguards.
We do have to worry about the spread of WMD, and in particular nuclear weapons, whether it's from the Russian arsenal, Pakistan, North Korea, potentially Iran down the road. The fact that nuclear weapons are proliferating is in many ways the ultimate nightmare, because I think the most devastating short-term national security threat we face is the potential of terrorists getting their hands on nuclear weapons, because at that point you could have a terrorist cell of, let's say, 20 individuals that has more killing power than the entire army of a non-nuclear state like Germany or Brazil. That's a pretty terrifying scenario to think about.
You've also got, particularly if Iran gets a hold of a nuclear weapon, you've got an ongoing battle in terms of other armaments. Maybe under the present Egyptian leadership, there isn't as much enmity toward the Republic of Iran, but traditionally the Saudis have had a lot of enmity. They may want to get a weapon then and so forth. I mean,
you could see a nuclear arms race in the Middle East,
exactly.
Which is a pretty terrifying scenario.
Well, there are a lot of terrifying scenarios, and some of them you write about here with Verve, and yet bring history into our consciousness in a way that always makes me think to ask, how much does the past teach us about dealing with the present? You know, the Saniana thing about we're all condemned to repeat the past. One would like to think and hope otherwise. Your thoughts?
Well, I think the past certainly informs our view of the present, and when you think about various policy actions you can take today, a lot of the way we think about it is really based on our reading of what's happened in the past, because there's no way to carry out a controlled experiment, so you just try to inductively reason from what's happened in the past. And that's why I think it's essential that we have a knowledge of the history of insurgency and counterinsurgency, because these issues are not going away. Just because we're out of Iraq, just because we're going to leave Afghanistan, the threat of irregular warfare is not going to disappear. It's always been around, always will be around, will continue to be the dominant form of warfare. So we'd better study that history to figure out what's ahead of us.
And it's all there for you to read in the book. Some are calling it the best military history of its kind since Clausewitz, Invisible Army, an Epic History of Guerrilla Warfare from Ancient Times to the Present. Always good to have you here. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on again. Always a great conversation.
And take care of that cough.
I'll try.
And before we say goodbye for today, we're going to dedicate just a few minutes here to following up on past segments and sharing feedback that we've received from you, our listeners. After our recent show on quality preschool, we received lots of suggestions that the family should play a larger role in educating young children. Jen wrote, federally funded education should require parent participation. Parents should have to attend occasional parenting education classes and have deliverables to ensure they're engaging their children at home. We can't throw money at early childhood education without expecting and requiring parent participation, or else we're just funding daycare. And a few listeners shared stories about the compensation in early childhood education. Terry wrote, my niece has her BA in early childhood education with a master teacher credential. Jobs in her field pay little more than minimum wage. She earned more in customer service with AT&T. We don't value ECE because we don't pay the people who provide it. And we recently profiled local journalist Kevin Weston, who has been diagnosed with leukemia, needs a bone marrow transplant. He's African-American, and his cause has raised awareness to the low rate of minority donor participation. Several listeners found his story motivating. Lynn from Fairfax said, I just took a minute to request my kit. Thanks for letting me know about this important need. I was not aware before today. Best wishes to Kevin. But others were dismayed to find out that they didn't qualify to join the bone marrow registry and wondered what they could do to help. And so we asked Carol Gillespie, executive director of the Asian American Donor Program.
Yeah, you know, it's a sad thing. There are so many people that feel great after 45 and they wonder why they can't register. But there's so many other things that they could do. They could volunteer with AADP. Now, that doesn't mean that they're going to be in our office stuffing envelopes. They would be preparing the kits that actually go out to our drives. And we depend on volunteers a lot in the office to prepare these kits so that we can go out and do what we do. Also, if they would like to volunteer at a drive in their area, we can put them to work.
And if you are between the ages of 18 and 44 and would like to sign up for the registry, there will be a drive this Saturday from 9 to 2 at the HP Pavilion in San Jose. More details are at kevinandlatifah.com. Last week, author and historian Gary Wills joined us to discuss what he views as the failed tradition of priests, and that show elicited strong reactions. Elaine said, "I'm no apologist for the Catholic Church, far from it, but I would appreciate more speakers who represent the moderate Catholic voice. I'm disappointed that you tend to give prime time to the conversations that are critical of mainstream faith, but give less airplay to active moderate Catholics and other mainline Christians. Perhaps I'm biased, but I sense an unspoken assumption that mainline tradition is not for thinking people, that it's completely locked into childlike belief systems. That's not true." And Andy shared his displeasure with the segment. He said, "How many stories on Catholicism are you going to do? With the Pope news and other large national and international items lately, do we need yet another angle on this ancient yet tiny fraction of the U.S. population that is even tinier here in the Bay Area?" Thanks to all our listeners for your feedback. If you have a question regarding something you hear on Forum, you can reach us on Facebook or by emailing forum@kqed.org. And again, we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to extend thanks to our producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai, who put that last segment together. Our interns are Lauren Benishu, Ben Gill, Nora McCartan, Layla Samini, and Jasmine Nguyen. And Danny Bringer is on controls. Executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.